Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Illustration Department podcast. I am your host, Giuseppe Castellano. In this podcast, I talk to folks in illustration, animation, and other creative fields about their beginnings, their successes, and the bumps and bruises they've experienced along the way. In this episode, I talk to author and illustrator Javaka Stepto. I asked Javaka about his father, the legendary John Stepto, and what it was like growing up with him. Among other topics, Javaka talks about living in New York City in the 1970s and 80s. He explains why collage for him is a, quote, means of survival. And he shares his thoughts on Jean-Michel Basquiat. Javaka also describes what it's like to get a 3 a.m. phone call from the Caldecott Committee. I hope you enjoy our conversation. So thank you for being on the podcast, Javaka.
Not a problem. Pleasure to be here.
What are you up to these days?
Just working on more books. I mean, I feel like, you know, if you're a working artist, you always have projects somewhere in the back of your head. And the question is, you know, how soon can you get it to the forefront of what it is that you're doing?
Right.
So,
Are you working on like multiple books at once?
Yeah. And the thing is there's one, you know, leader of the pack that you're spending more time on, but the other stuff, you know, like if you pass a bookstore and you see a book that would be good for research for a project for another one, you're picking that book up, you're reading it. If stuff lands in your lap, you're definitely taking advantage of it, but you might not be planning trips or, you know, doing any of the heavy research for other stuff just yet.
Right. So I want to talk to you a little bit about kind of where you grew up and take that through to your career. And we have a lot to chat about. So I typically like to start off just simply by asking, where are you from?
I'm from New York City. I was born in Harlem Hospital. Mm-hmm. My parents were both New Yorkers. My father grew up in Brooklyn. My mother grew up in Manhattan and the Bronx. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of shuttled between both of them.
What neighborhood did you grow up in?
In the Bronx with my mother, I would say I primarily grew up around Yankee Stadium, 161st Street, Walton Avenue in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. With my father, we lived on Riverside Drive, and we also lived in Brooklyn. Those are kind of the three neighborhoods. And then I would just say add a fourth one, which is Harlem River Projects. That's where my grandmother lived. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would go to, you know, either my mother's house or my father's house, depending on where they were living at the time. Right. So that, you know, would either mean going to Upper Manhattan or going to Brooklyn or the Bronx. Or
what was it like growing up? I mean, what was it like traversing New York City back in the early, mid and late 70s, early 80s?
It was definitely a different world. You know what? A lot of times people can complain about the buses and trains, but if you were living in New York in the 70s, you knew what it was like to not have a train come on time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because trains would be an hour late, and especially at nighttime. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you're not getting a train in 5 minutes, people are complaining.
Right.
And I just remember, you know, like waiting on a cold, cold night on a platform. Mm-hmm. Or like being stuck in between stations for an hour or more. And so to me, the train system has gotten a lot better.
Yeah.
you know, it's not perfect, and it'll probably never be perfect, but it has gotten a lot better. Lots of graffiti, lots of different characters in New York. People really interested in being unique and celebrating their uniqueness. It was the beginning of hip hop. A lot of things that New York was really known for is was just kind of happening back then. Back then, Ed Koch had his plan for Times Square the way it looks right now. And so, like, that was beginning. So, you know, we went from, like, pimps and pushers and, you know, all sorts of craziness in 42nd Street. And now we have, like, Disney characters and superheroes walking around.
How old were you when you first took public transit by yourself?
I couldn't even tell you. I know, like, due to the fact that my parents weren't together, my sister, my brother, and I, we would take the bus. And funny enough, it was just one bus that we had to take. And so, you know, our parents would put us on that bus. But it was just a part of you know, growing up. And then also a lot of times after first grade, we didn't go to school in our neighborhood. So, you know, we were kind of just always on a bus, a train or something.
I'm actually having that experience right now. My son is 11 and he's in seventh grade. And, you know, last year he took the school bus, the yellow bus. But now he's got to take public transit. And today is day four of his experience taking the public bus by himself. And, you know, emotionally, I'm feeling all sorts of things. I'm like, buddy, what is it like? And he goes, actually, it's a lot better than the school bus. And I go, okay, and anything else? And he's like, yeah, but the service sucks. And it's like, sir, you are now a New Yorker complaining about the MCA.
Yeah. And the other thing is he's not alone. New Yorkers are really helpful. And then I'm pretty sure there are people on the bus that go to his school.
Oh, for sure.
That he'll become friends with if he's not friends with already.
Yeah, he's actually enjoying it far more than the school bus. So that's good.
Yeah.
So you mentioned your father. And for anyone who doesn't know, your father is John Steptoe, the renowned author illustrator.
Correct.
There are a few things I want to talk a little bit about with regards to your father. So he, for again, it's just a, you know, 30-second history lesson here. When your father was a teenager, and by the way, correct me if any of my facts are wrong here, but when your father was a teenager, and a teacher recommended that he meet Ursula Nordstrom, and he did. And Ursula Nordstrom was wowed by his talent and immediately set to working with him on making a book. She's in her letters to him, wrote a lot of times to the effect that, you know, this is, you are a talent, you are a wonderful talent. And, I know what you're going to be doing is going to be great. So let's work on something together. And they did. And it took about 3 years, but they ended up, creating Stevie.
Right.
Which is one of the major sea changes, I think, in children's publishing for a lot of reasons. This was published in 1969. There weren't a whole lot of books about black kids or the black experience. Of course, your dad's art was transcendent and just lovely. And the text was unlike anything that anyone else was doing. And so this is 69. You were born a couple years later.
Yes.
He was working on... what was that book called? He was working on Train Ride. And I think Train Ride came out the same year you were born, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, John Steptoe went on to create, I think, something along 10, 15 books or so. He won several Caldecotts. And so you grew up with that. What was it like hanging out with your dad and seeing him work through these books that he was working through?
So just a correction, he wrote and illustrated 12 books, and he illustrated 16 books. So those other books are with people like Arnold A. Adolf, Eloise Greenfield, you know, people like that. So growing up, I mean, your parents are your parents,
right?
You know, so like they're regular people, and you know, you see them for the strengths and, you know, the downfalls and things that you see them go through. It was just kind of regular life. We understood that, you know, not everybody was an artist, because I had friends and their parents would kind of marvel at the fact that there was actually, you know, like this black man creating art for a living, and not having to go to a 9-to-5. And, you know, like I would always or often get the question, what are you going to do when you grow up? And, you know, I would tell people I'm an artist and I'll be an artist. And they would say, well, how are you going to make a living? And to me, that was such a strange response because, you know, both of my parents were artists,
right,
and they were living. And then they had children, and their children were alive, too. So, you know, like, why are you even asking that question?
Oh, we know why. Lots of reasons why people ask that question.
Yeah. You understand. Yeah. To me, it just was a strange question.
Right.
And then also, you know, just a lot of people thought I was strange and different because of how my parents perceived the world and the way that they lived in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, we had stuff like tofu and honey and wheat bread. You know, like my cousins didn't want to come over our house to eat because all of that stuff was strange to them. But it was just part of life, you know.
Right. Yeah.
My sister and I would be playing outside or in our room or whatever, and my father would say, "Hey, I need you to pose for me. Sit here, stand here, hold this. Put your arm like this," you know, and he would pull out his sketch pad or he would pull out a camera.
Yeah.
You know, a couple of days later, there would be a sketch or like a finished piece.
Right.
You know.
Do you remember enjoying it or were you like, oh, come on, Dad?
Yeah, of course. You know, like if you're in the middle of something, you're like, ah, you know. If like I'm playing baseball or something with the kids, you know, outside, of course I don't want to stop in the middle of a game.
Right.
But there was definitely an understanding of there was something special happening because, especially in school, teachers would kind of make a big deal out of us, you know. Oh, you're John Steptoe's son. Or other kids would ask us, what is it like to be in a children's book?
Did you ever go with your dad to any meetings? Did you ever meet any editors?
Yeah, yes and no. What would usually happen is we would be there for the beginning of the meeting. And then all editors have a big bookshelf filled with books. And they would just, you know, like kind of let us go shopping. And I remember just going there empty handed and coming back home with, you know, like a shopping bag full of books.
Right.
And usually whether it was just me or my sister and I, they would just give us some books and we would read and they would discuss whatever they had to discuss.
What did your dad's studio look like?
When we lived at Riverside Drive, I guess he just took a bedroom or maybe it was the living room. He always had a large table, a mechanical table where you can adjust the pitch and height and things like that.
Right.
He wasn't a sloppy artist, you know.
Right.
He had his things organized, his paintbrushes, his whatever his tools were. And I say it that way because he experimented and he used lots of different techniques when working. So, you know, like one book would require him to create stencils. Mm-hmm. The next book, it might be watercolor and pen and ink. So whatever tools he was using, he loved experimenting and trying out new techniques and would get really excited, you know, like, Javaka, look at this pen. And I'm like, it's a pen. He's like, you don't know, this pen could... And so he would share his excitement, you know, about what it is that he was doing.
Mm-hmm. Were his doors open? Did he allow you just to sort of play around while he was painting or not?
His doors were open, but, you know, like we had our own space to play.
Right.
I don't remember him telling us, you know, don't come and play in here or saying anything like that. But when he was working, I think we just kind of let him work. I would be in my space and I would be drawing and my sister, she would be doing whatever she was doing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, he obviously, like I was saying before, you know, Ursula Nordstrom, they met and created a few books together and had a relationship that, from what I'm gathering, was a positive one generally, but yes, wasn't without frustrations and struggles.
Right.
Is that a fair assessment?
I would say so. He wasn't always the most disciplined person. And so, yeah.
There's a letter from her to your father that was dated in 1967. So this is 2 years before Stevie came out. Mm-hmm. And in it, she was saying, you know, Dear John, it was so great to see you. I'm so happy to, you know, be working with you. And she then goes on to say, here are the next steps. And then in her letter, she lays out how to create a book dummy. Here's what she said. I was deeply interested in what you told me about someone's mother babysitting, and I think you should try to turn it into a picture book of your own. The first thing to do is to prepare a very, very rough dummy. I talked to you about this the day you were in, but I repeat it now. I suggest you take 16 pieces of paper, 8x10 or 10x8 if you prefer, and make a 32-page dummy starting on the first right-hand page as page 1 and ending on the last page as 32. Allow one page for a title page, one for a copyright, one for a half title or dedication, and start the story and pictures on the double spread made by pages 4 and 5. Really clear, concise directions on how to make a dummy book that I think all illustrators can easily follow that to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously he took that and worked on Stevie. When Stevie came out, she sent him a telegram through Western Union.
And, yeah, that's so long ago, right?
Yeah.
That's so dated.
It is. And in it, she says, happy publication date, dear painter. Yeah. Affectionately, UN. Do you know what the date of that telegram is?
I don't.
September 10th, 1969. Today's date, 50 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah. I guess it's good that I missed the first phone call.
Yeah, and I promise, this is not a lie. I promise to anyone listening to this, this is not planned. I was looking, I was doing a little research, and I saw that, and I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah, so, wow, know. Yeah.
Yeah, so 50 years ago today, man.
That's the way the world works sometimes.
Yeah, it does. For sure it does. You know, obviously growing up, you're creating art, you're hanging out with your parents who are artists, and you decide, I'm going to be an artist. This is what I'm going to do. It's just a natural thing for me. You end up going to Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to point out something that's interesting. Did you know that Ashley Bryan also went to Cooper?
Yes.
And when he was thinking about going to art schools, people were telling him, there's no way you're going to go to art school because of your skin color, because you're black.
Right.
And he made it into Cooper because Cooper had a blind admission policy.
We've come a long way, but we still have a long way to go.
What was your first official illustration job?
Even before graduating, I went to Lee and Low Books and I showed them my portfolio. And so before I graduated, I actually had a book deal.
Which book was it?
This is for In Daddy's Arms, I Am Tall. Pat Cummings, she's been a friend of the family for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And so she told me about Lee and Low, and I think I also remember having a conversation with my father, just speaking about how you have to learn how to draw children. Mm-hmm. And they have to look natural and comfortable, and they can't look like, you know, little men and women,
right.
You know. And so I specifically created some sketches of men with children in lots of different situations. You know, one was a principal taking two kids, you know, to the office. There was one with a man holding a kid on his shoulders, giving him a ride on his shoulders. Mm-hmm. There's one, you know, holding the kid in his arms. So just lots of instances and circumstances. And the people at Lee and Low, you know, seem to gravitate towards those sketches. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing was that the drawings were charcoal drawings. You know, they were something that I did quickly, and it wasn't like it took days or weeks to create. They were just, you know, simple charcoal drawings. Mm-hmm. But they gravitated to those. And I think their thought was that I was going to make, you know, the illustrations to In Daddy's Arms like that. But I have this thing where, like, I always want to do, you know, not just create something, but, you know, create something that's really astounding, right, that will really impress people. And so because of that, I decided to work in collage so that I could, you know, do some really interesting things. Mm-hmm.
You've said that collage is a means of survival.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that? Can you expand on it?
Basically, you know, people, as a way of surviving, they've created opportunities from things that were not necessarily meant for that particular purpose.
Right.
And, you know, you see it in quilts, you know, mm-hmm. and what they do is they take scraps from a burlap bag and somebody's shirt and fabric from something else, mm-hmm. A curtain, and you put it together and you have this very beautiful blanket. That's how people survive. That's how people are able to get along, by mm-hmm. using their creativity, by using ingenuity, mm-hmm. and by not putting so many lines up, understanding that meaning is kind of in the moment. Mm-hmm. And then as the moment changes, the meaning and the use of an object can also change.
How many books have you worked on since your first one?
I think altogether I've worked on 12 books.
There's one in particular that I want to focus on for obvious reasons.
Okay.
I wanted to talk about Radiant Child.
Mm-hmm.
It's the story of Jean-Michel Basquiat. And it won the Caldecott a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Before we get into the book, and before we get into the life of Basquiat, you won the Caldecott for it. Can you just describe how did they contact you? How did you find out that you had won? And how did you feel about that?
There's a big conference that ALA does, and it's called the Midwinter. Mm-hmm. And this is the conference where a lot of awards are decided. So, you know, you have the Caldecott, you have the Coretta Scott King, they have this ceremony where everyone gets there maybe like at 5 o'clock in the morning and decides to call, people up at like 6 or 7 in the morning on a Saturday or a Sunday. That year, I happened to be in Seattle. The midwinter conference was happening in Atlanta, so it happened to be 3 o'clock in the morning. Before you get a phone call, you possibly have an idea that you might be in the runnings for an award or an honor, because, you know, a lot of people have like Mock Caldecott, Mock Coretta Scott King.
Right.
I felt like there was a possibility that I might get something, but I wasn't really sure. I seemed to be in the top 10 books for everybody's mock. But in the last 2 weeks, I dropped out of the top 10. And I was like 11, 12. And so I was like, I hope, but, you know, I'll be happy, you know, for whatever. And the thing is like, it's an honor to be in a top 10, period. And I say that because, you know, like the people who are doing the mock awards are just regular people. And regular people are the people who are buying your book.
Right.
The fact that, you know, some kid in Boise, Idaho says, yeah, I think this will be, you know, this is a great book. That's important. So I don't know what's going to happen. I know that there's a possibility of me getting a phone call. It's like 3 o'clock, 3 in the morning, and I'm in Seattle. I'm there with my girlfriend, and I put the phone 2 rooms away.
Why did you do that?
Just because, like, I was really kind of nervous, and I figured if I made it harder to answer the phone, it would most likely ring. So I get a phone call, and, you know, like I'm sleeping, and so I wake up and I try to get to the phone call, and then when I pick up the phone, it stops ringing, and there's nobody. Exactly. So then I'm like, who just called me? And then, like 10 minutes later, I get a phone call, and it's the Coretta Scott King people, and so they, you know, they're like, "Good morning. Is this Jabaka Stepso?" "Yes. You won a Coretta Scott King Award." And then you hear like this big roar in the background of people yelling and screaming. It's a really great phone call. So, you know, I say thank you. I'm happy. I'm excited. And, you know, we say whatever we have to say to each other, and then we hang up. And the cool, the great thing about that phone call, it was Rudine Sims Bishop, and I've known her since my first book, In Daddy's Arms, I Am Tall. So it was nice to get that phone call from someone I knew.
Right.
But I never asked her if she just called me. So I hang up, and I'm like, so was the first call I missed, was that like Rudine calling me, or was it somebody else? I didn't know what to do, because it's not like I could call Rudine back and say, "Hey, did you just call me before you called me?" And so I remember the Ziggy cartoon where he's like waiting for a phone call, waiting for a phone call, waiting for a phone call. The sun goes up. The sun goes down, and he's like, "Okay, I know what I'm going to do. I have to take matters into my own hand." And he gets in the tub. And as soon as he gets in the tub, of course, the phone rings.
Right.
And so I was like, "Okay, I am not going to run a tub, but I'm going to get in the shower." So I get in the shower. I'm in the shower for maybe like 2 minutes, and my girlfriend is yelling, "The phone, the phone, the phone." And so I run out.
Course.
Yeah. And then it's the Caldecott people says, "Congratulations, you won the Caldecott Award." In my head, I'm expecting her to say honor or, but everybody starts screaming. It's kind of a shock because I'm not ready for the moment. I missed the moment because I was like, is it the honor? Is it the award? Is it? I don't know. I guess I'm just kind of in shock.
Right.
And
You're all soaked in. Oh
yeah.
my gosh. That's funny.
I did not need a photo at that moment. I just like I got off the phone and I was just really quiet, you know, because it was a really big moment. That was like a pivotal moment in my life.
And that book was about Jean-Michel Basquiat.
Yes.
And the thing with Basquiat was that, he is the highest grossing American artist of all time. I mean, a painting that
Right.
he created back in 82 sold recently for $110 million, beating
Yes.
Warhol. And I just feel like the more I think about Basquiat and the more I read up about him, the more I kind of realize that, like, maybe I'm now realizing this, and this is something that everyone else has realized for years. He just doesn't get the attention and the respect and the accolades. I mean, he gets some of that, but I just don't think he gets enough of it. And there's one thing I wanted to point out, and then I have a question for you. I'm kind of leading up to a question, but there's one. So I was doing some research on Basquiat, and if you bear with me, I have a little bit of a story and a little bit of a frustration to vent. So I was doing some research on him, and he was a Brooklyn boy like you. He was kind of like, I don't like self-taught, but he didn't go to the true he didn't learn art through the traditional methods. He just sort of did what he did. And so anyway, so he's painting in the early 80s, and he gets interviewed in 1983 by this guy named Mark Miller. And Mark has a degree in art history from NYU. And I'm saying that for a reason, and I will explain why in a minute. So anyway, so here's this interview, and it is online, and I'm going to post this link of the interview in the show notes. I think everyone should watch that video. It's not long. It's 83. They're in Basquiat's studio. And Mark Miller, who is he's a critic, he's a curator. The interview is frustrating because he asks Basquiat to point out aspects of a certain painting on a wall. And there's one moment where he says, "What's this?" And Basquiat says, "That's a belt." "A belt? Yeah, that's a belt." "A belt? Yeah, a belt." And he's like, "Okay, let's move over to this. What's that?" "Oh, that's a flea." And Mark Miller goes, "A flea?" And Basquiat's like, "Yeah, flea." And Mark goes, "Looks like a chicken." And Basquiat's like, "No, it's a flea." And it goes on and on like that for a few minutes. It is very clear that Mark has zero respect for Basquiat or his work. And Basquiat realizes this at about 5 or 6 minutes in, because he's like, "Well, can you explain this art?" And Basquiat's like, "Most of it is, he's like, I took elements of from my life and from my, doing research at the Met." And Basquiat's like, eloquence is obvious. His intelligence is obvious. He cites Rauschenberg. He cites Duchamp. He references Italian philosophy. I mean, that's Basquiat. On the other hand, on the other side, Mark Miller is saying, just like, "What's that? A flea?" "No, it's not. It's not, And so anyways, Basquiat realizes this interview is for the birds, and ends up shoving food in his mouth. And for the rest of the interview, Basquiat answers Mark Miller's questions with a mouthful full of food. So, and it obviously, you can clearly see Mark being frustrated. He's like, oh, come on, you're not supposed to do that in front of the cameras.
Right, but you're not supposed to ask stupid questions.
Right. There you go. There you go. And so I was listening, I was watching this thing, and it just boiled my blood. And I don't know if that's a microcosm of how Basquiat was seen throughout his part, his life, his sort of short life. And maybe now people are right now realizing what he contributed to the fine art world. All of this is to say, what was your impetus for Radiant Child?
Exactly what you just talked about. I remember having a conversation with this young woman. She's African American. I don't know her, but we were just talking, and she was saying, you know, her first experience with Basquiat was watching the movie Basquiat, and it just made her really depressed because of the way that Jean-Michel Basquiat was portrayed. Mm-hmm. And you have all of these artists of color that are happy to see someone, you know, that looks like them. And they're in museums and, mm-hmm. you know, internationally renowned. And all the world could think to say is something negative about them. I said to myself, there has to be more than that, you know. When we think of Jackson Pollock, we don't think of him peeing in you know, one of his benefactors' fireplace. You know, that's not the first thing that comes to mind.
No. Or if you think of Caravaggio, you don't think of him killing someone.
Right. But when you know, a lot of times when Basquiat is talked about, like even the fact that of calling him a graffiti writer. Even though he you know, created art on the walls of the street, it wasn't graffiti in the sense of the way that we think of hip hop graffiti, mm-hmm. you know, because it wasn't about style and it wasn't about marking territory. It was about creating a message, asking people to think. It passed all of the different tests that we have for fine art. You know, like throughout his career, you know, racism was very prevalent, and he was very frustrated by it. Especially, I don't know if you remember Michael Stewart, and Michael Stewart was an actual graffiti writer, and he was found writing graffiti in the subway, and he was actually killed by New York City policemen. Michael Stewart was also in Basquiat's circle. And so that kind of messed him up. And so when we look at Jean-Michel and the fact that he took drugs, imagine what he had to deal with. You know, like as a black man, constantly being attacked. Mm-hmm. When you hear commentaries about Basquiat, everybody says, oh, he took advantage of me. Well, what was the situation? Well, I was at his house. I was eating his food. I was, you know,
right.
riding his coattails. But he was taking advantage of me. And he's alone. And interestingly enough, the only person he can really call a friend is Andy Warhol, mm-hmm. who is like known for taking advantage of everybody else.
Right.
When I was at the Brooklyn Museum, when they had an exhibit about his work in 2005, and I, you know, just like, had a chance to really seriously look at his work without any of the hype, you know, and just seeing the brilliance of who he is, mm-hmm. expressed through his work alone, without him having to be there and explain it to me. I said to myself, he needs for people to really understand him, to really understand his humanity,
right.
Because I think that is the part of the story that wasn't being told.
There's a funny Keith Haring story with Basquiat. It goes something like, Keith Haring is, this is the late 70s, so Basquiat's tagging,
right.
I don't know if the right phrase is, I don't know if tagging is the right way of saying this, but he's going around and he's putting up Samo, which was, mm-hmm. I guess his name or sort of a critique on, I don't know if it was a critique on the world generally or a critique on the fine art world, the Samo, like same old stuff.
It's probably both.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at his use of language, it's always layered.
So anyway, so it's 1979. Keith Haring is aware of Samo. And he's sort of following along, trying to find out who is this person, who is Samo.
Mm-hmm.
So one day Keith Haring walks into SVA and, a young man approaches him and says, "Hey, would you mind walking me through past the security
mm-hmm.
guards?" And Keith Haring thought nothing of it and said, "Yeah, sure, no problem." So they walk in, they go past the security guards. Keith Haring jumps into a class. A little while later, he comes out and he sees poems and tags on the walls where they weren't there before.
Right.
And he realized that he just met Samo.
Samo, yeah.
Later that day, they bump into each other and he asks the kid, did you put up that graffiti in the walls of SVA? And Basquiat said, "Yeah, I did." And Keith Haring realized this is Samo, and they became friends. I don't know what the
mm-hmm.
relationship was like over the years, but that was how they met.
Right. Funny enough, people who went to school with me remember Jean-Michel like walking in on critiques. He was just kind of known for sneaking into our classes in our schools.
So it was a pattern.
Yeah. And I mean, the thing is, he was really diligent about his art education,
mm-hmm.
you know, even though he didn't go to, even though he didn't receive a degree from an art college, he definitely attended.
Fast forward a few months or fast forward maybe a few years, however long it took, and you get to a point where you're like, I have this book, I have this idea, I've made some drawings, I've written some text. Who did you approach? I mean, how did it become ultimately a Caldecott winning book?
So I had an agent at the time,
mm-hmm.
and I told him that I wanted to do a Jean-Michel Basquiat book, and he got really excited. One day he happened to be out with a publisher at Little Brown, and this was after Radiant Child, the documentary, happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think she recently saw the documentary, and they were talking, and she was like, she said to him, someone should do a book about Jean-Michel Basquiat. And he said, well, I just spoke to Javak Costepto, and he said, and so that's the way it happened. Serendipity.
How long did it take you to create the book from like inception to final package to the publisher with your art?
About 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of reading and a lot of research.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had to figure out how I wanted to create the artwork. So I looked at his artwork, how it was constructed.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at the colors he used. I thought about where he lived, trying to figure out like what can be told through the pictures and what needs to be said.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, the story is the most important thing.
Right.
The story about a boy who grows up, you know, to fulfill his dreams.
Your book just sort of kicked off in me a need to sort of fully understand, or at least understand a little bit further, that he wasn't just, you know, this guy within this moment, bookended by, you know, or sort of overshadowed, I guess, by Warhol. You know, so much more than that. And to that end, I'm sure I'm not the first person to say this. there are certain similarities, more than certain similarities, between your work.
His life and my life. My work and his work.
Well, I was going to say work, but I guess life too. Yeah, I mean, your work. He mentioned the random. He called it the random. Some elements of sort of like allowing the process to dictate the final product. Yeah. And so if anyone looks at your any of your books or any of your work, but specifically with Radiant Child, they can certainly see it's not all totally premeditated. There's so much, there's like a random flow to so much of how you put piece together the compositions. And you see that also when you're looking at Basquiat's work. So obviously, visually, there are a lot of similarities.
I don't know where that came from. Maybe it was just the time, because the reality is that, like, I experienced a lot of the New York that Basquiat experienced. Mm-hmm. I think part of that was just dealing with stuff, random stuff. Like, mm-hmm. we had to deal with it, and we didn't expect perfection. So I'm just trying to parse it out.
Right.
I don't know exactly what it is, but there has to be something in our combined past that made us think in similar ways.
Right. So I want to kind of tie this all together, and also just again to say thank you for being on this podcast. I really enjoy talking to you about so much of these topics today.
Likewise.
Sitting with us is an illustrator, you know, they're tapping at the door being a children's book author and illustrator, or they've been at it for a few years, or they've been at it for more than a few years. What mm-hmm. Let's leave them with maybe one bit of advice.
I do this out of love, you know. I do this whether I would get paid a lot of money or not. Mm-hmm. I feel that's important, especially as an African American, just because I think that, you know, the world is definitely changing, and we as human beings are getting better in terms of, you know, how we think about other people and how we respect other people. Mm-hmm. But I feel like there's so much, you know, more to be done. And so part of that is sharing our stories, correcting mistakes, and appreciating the stories that other people tell. Mm-hmm. Because of that, you know, I love doing what it is that I do, like to be paid for whatever it is that you're interested in. That's an incredible, incredible honor. Having that love for what you do is really important. Mm-hmm. And then also patience, and not patience in a way, you know, just wait, you know, somebody will give you a chance, but patience in the way of, you know, have a plan and wait for your opportunity to take the next step, and then take the next step, and then take the next step.
To learn more about Javaka, visit javaka.com. If you enjoyed our conversation, please share it online, subscribe to the podcast, and leave us a positive rating and review. This helps us find new listeners, and on a personal note, it would be nice to know that the podcast is helping. Continue the conversation in the comment section of each episode at illustrationdepartment.com/podcast. This podcast is produced by the Illustration Department, a global leader in online education for illustrators. Visit us at illustrationdept.com for class offerings, testimonials, the alumni showcase, and more. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.